Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dan Novak, Ashley Thompson, and Katie Weaver. Dan Novak's story looks at ways self-driving car companies are thinking of using humans to provide peace of mind for passengers. After that, Ashley and Katie have a story about children adopted from South Korea in the 1970s and 1980s. They want the truth about what led to their adoptions. Then I'll bring you the Higher Education Report. In a time when many are choosing not to go to college, this university is gaining students. Finally, you'll hear from Anna Mateo with this week's words and their stories. If you like sandwiches, you will want to listen. And now, here's Dan Novak.
Makers of self-driving or autonomous vehicles have raised tens of billions of dollars based on promises to develop the fully robotic product. However, industry leaders and experts say the technology may forever require human supervision. Supporters of autonomous vehicles, or AVs, say that computers and robotic technology will reduce the number of traffic accidents. But in reality, making self-driving cars safer than human-operated is complex. Self-driving programming lacks the human ability to predict and recognize risk quickly. Kyle Vogt is the head of Cruise, a unit of American car company General Motors, or GM. When asked if he believed humans could ever be completely free of vehicle operation, Vogt questioned the worthiness of such a goal. "I can provide my customers peace of mind, knowing there is always a human there to help if needed," he said. "I don't know why I'd ever want to get rid of that." GM recalled and updated software in 80 Cruise self-driving vehicles this month after a crash in June. Two people were injured in the accident in San Francisco, California. U.S. safety officials said the recalled software could incorrectly predict an oncoming vehicle's path. Cruise said its vehicles would not make the same mistake again after the update. For some, the need for human supervision increases doubt about the technology. And entirely self-driving vehicles are far behind in development that industry leaders have promised. In 2018, GM sought U.S. government approval for a fully autonomous car. It had no steering wheel or brake or gas pedals. It was to be marketed in 2019. But that vehicle, the Cruise Origin, now is not expected to begin production until spring 2023, Vogt said. In 2019, Tesla head Elon Musk promised 1 million robo-taxis would be in place by 2020. His company's full self-driving feature has been criticized because its cars use human operators. In June, Musk said that building self-driving cars had been far more difficult than he had expected. Mike Wagner is with Edge Case Research, which helps AV companies analyze risk. He said, "If these companies don't succeed over the next 2 years, they're not going to exist anymore." Many AV companies today use humans as remote piloting supervisors. They support self-driving cars in dealing with unexpected events on the road. The industry calls these edge cases. Edge cases could include street closures for road work or unpredictable actions by a human driver or walker. When a self-driving car experiences an edge case, it puts its hands up and says, "I don't know what's going on," said Kusha Kave. He is with Imperium Drive, which is using humans as remote operators for cars in the British city of Milton Keynes. Kave said their work is similar to air traffic controllers, but for autonomous cars instead of planes. Cruise's Vote says the company's AVs on the roads in San Francisco currently depend on humans less than 1% of the time. But across thousands or even millions of AVs, that would add up to a large amount of time stopped on the road waiting for human guidance. Autonomous systems are not as effective as people because their perception and prediction algorithms are not as good as how a human brain processes and decides, said expert Chris Burini-Bird. He has worked with self-driving vehicles with GM and Waymo. For example, Burini-Bird said a human seeing a ball roll into a road is likely to immediately recognize that a child might be chasing that ball. AVs will not. So a human driver will reduce speed far more quickly than an AV in such an edge case. That worries Burini-Bird. "I am concerned that AV companies will rush to market without proving the safety is better than human-driven vehicles," he said. I'm Dan Novak.
For 40 years, Louise Kwong believed her biological parents were dead. She had been adopted from South Korea in 1976 by a couple from Denmark. Kwong was told she had been found alone on the streets of the South Korean city of Busan as a baby. That is what she had always been told about her early life. But that understanding of her identity collapsed in 2016. The South Korean agency that processed her adoption admitted it had lied about Kwong. It said the story she was told was created to increase her chances of getting adopted. Kwong received a letter from a social worker at the Korea Social Service, KSS. The social worker provided the true story. The agency, in fact, knew about Kwong's biological parents. There is no evidence that Kwong was ever in Busan, a city several hours by car from the country's capital, Seoul. That is where her father was living in 1976, the year of Kwong's adoption. "I was not an orphan. I have never been to Busan, nor at the orphanage in Busan," Kwong said recently at a news conference in Seoul. "This was all a lie made up for adoption procedure. I have been made non-existent in Korea to get me out of Korea as fast as possible."
About 300 South Korean adoptees in Europe and the United States are calling for South Korea's government to investigate their adoption. The adoptees suspect their adoption procedures were based on falsified documents. Their effort marks a deepening divide between the world's largest population of adoptees and their birth nation. The effort also comes years after the Korean children were carelessly removed from their families, a practice that was at its highest in the 1980s. The Denmark-based group representing the adoptees presented a letter this week to the office of South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol. In the letter, the group urged him to prevent agencies from destroying records or punishing adoptees seeking information about their past. Seoul's Truth and Reconciliation Commission has received 283 applications from adoptees so far. The applications describe numerous complaints about lost or false biological stories. Some adoptees say they discovered the adoption agencies changed their identities to replace other children who died, were too sick to travel, or were retaken by their Korean family before they could be sent to Western adopters. Adoptees note that such findings deepen their sense of loss. Peter Mulla is a lawyer and co-founder of the Danish-Korean Rights Group. He said he also plans to take legal action against two Seoul-based agencies, Holt Children's Services and KSS, over their unwillingness to fully open their records to adoptees. The agencies often note privacy issues related to birth parents to explain the restricted access to records. But Mulla accuses them of inventing excuses to avoid questions about their methods. Last month, his group first filed applications from 51 Danish adoptees, calling for the commission to investigate their adoptions. The move received intense attention from Korean adoptees around the world, leading the group to expand its campaign to adoptees outside of Denmark. The 232 additional applications received so far included 165 cases from Denmark, 36 cases from the United States, and 31 cases combined from Belgium, the Netherlands, Norway, and Germany. The Commission must decide in 3 or 4 months whether to open an investigation into the applications filed by adoptees. If it does, that could possibly lead to the most far-reaching investigation into foreign adoptions in the country. Holt did not immediately answer calls for comment. Chun-hee Kim, an adoption worker who has been with the KSS since the 1970s, said the agency is willing to discuss issues surrounding its adoptions with adoptees individually, but not with the media.
About 200,000 South Koreans were adopted overseas in the past 60 years, mainly to white parents in the United States and Europe, and mostly during the 1970s and 1980s. South Korea's then military leaders saw adoptions as a way to reduce the number of people to feed. They also saw adoption as a way to solve the problem of unmarried mothers and to deepen ties with the democratic West. Most of the South Korean adoptees sent overseas were registered by agencies as legal orphans found abandoned on the streets. Many of the adoptees, however, often had family members who could be easily identified or found. Special laws aimed at promoting foreign adoptions permitted private agencies to avoid usual child relinquishment steps, To relinquish means to give possession of something to another person or group. These laws let the agencies more easily export huge numbers of children to the West year after year. It was not until 2013 that South Korea's government required foreign adoptions to go through family courts. That ended the long-standing policy that permitted adoption agencies to dictate when children are considered released from their families. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
The number of students going to college in the U.S. has dropped by over 1 million since the spring of 2020. At that time, COVID-19 restrictions began going into effect everywhere in the U.S. In addition, a number of U.S. states are finding they have fewer college-age young people than in the past. Maine, a state in the northeastern U.S. next to Canada, is one of those states. A decreasing number of young people and the effects of COVID-19 measures make it difficult for large state universities to keep up their student numbers. But while universities in some states are having trouble bringing in new students, the University of Maine in the city of Orono is not. This is the case although Maine is far away from most other states and has 10% fewer state high school graduates than 10 years ago. During a time when fewer Americans are going to college, the University of Maine has been able to increase its number of undergraduate students by 5%. Why? A recent story in the publication Hechinger Report said the University of Maine is ahead of other states in recruiting and retention measures. The state is reducing the university's cost of attendance for students who come from other states and Canada. Because of scholarships and other financial aid, many students can go to Maine for the same price as a large university in their own state. For example, the University of Maine is advertising in nearby Massachusetts. The ads say, "Go to the University of Maine for the in-state cost of UMass." UMass stands for the University of Massachusetts. The university has about 12,000 students. While that seems like a lot, it is not nearly as many as big schools like Ohio State University, which has about 60,000. As a result, the school is trying to make a strong connection with both current and prospective students. University leaders say they are trying to get to know all students who visit, even those who decide to go elsewhere. Chris Richards is vice president of enrollment management. He said, "The school needs help from everyone to recruit the next class of students, not just the people who work in the admissions office. That was the old way. That model," he said, "isn't going to work anymore." One part of the new way is for university professors and researchers to make presentations about their work at nearby high schools. Another is to make visitors feel welcome. Richards described helping someone who seemed new to the school grounds find their way. "People want that," Richards said. M. Jeffrey is a new student from the nearby state of New Hampshire. She said she noticed the difference between visiting Maine and visiting other schools. "I definitely felt more welcomed. None of it felt forced," she said. Jerome Lucido studies college enrollment at the University of Southern California's School of Education. He said, "The University of Maine is on the right path. I do think there are lessons to be learned from what's going on in Maine right now," he said. Richards said his university recognized the problem about 10 years ago when the number of high school students in Maine started to fall. At one point, 80% of the university's students came from Maine. Now, about 40% come from other states. In addition, there are over 450 international students in a degree program at the University of Maine. Other international students are in the school's program for English learners. Orlina Botova is the director of international programs. She grew up in Bulgaria and came to study at the University of Maine. She completed postgraduate degrees there and has been working with international students since 2009. She said international students who are interested in the University of Maine will have to pay a similar cost compared to students coming from other states in the U.S., but the university does offer scholarships from $5,000 up to $20,000. In addition, the university offers teaching assistant positions for graduate students. Botova said her department does not do anything different from other schools in the northeastern U.S. to bring in international students. However, she said the university's goal of connecting with students extends to those from outside of the U.S. University officials travel to other countries to find students and meet their families. They even made some visits last year when other universities were not sending their representatives abroad. The university also tries to make sure international students feel cared for when they come to Maine.
Our population is small enough that we get to know our students. They have a really excellent experience on campus. So that experience really translates into a very high rating of the student experience on campus as an international student.
As a former international student herself, Botova said, she deeply cares about the experience students from other countries have while in Maine. She also wants students to know that it is possible to find out how to get a work visa and stay in the U.S. after finishing a study program. Botova said the school is also paying attention to students who come from countries with economic problems. The U.S. dollar is much stronger today than it was a year ago. That means it is more costly to go to an American school. Botova said the school will work with students who are already there, but may be having trouble paying. In addition, the University of Maine just announced that it will change the cost of going to school for students who come from a country like Ukraine, which is affected by war. They will now pay the same amount as students who come from Maine. That represents a big savings.
This is really the first time that we as an institution are looking at what is our mission as an institution to support displaced students by war.
She said the school is thinking about how it can help students find a pathway to education if their countries become destabilized. This year, there are 8 students from Ukraine attending the University of Maine. There is no guarantee the current ideas will keep working in the future, but Richards said he believes the university will keep working to solve the problem of decreasing student numbers. He said the leaders of the university recognize the problem. "The good thing for us," he said, "is that our leadership hasn't existed in a vacuum of false reality." I'm Dan Friedel.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in the English language. We give definitions, notes on usage, and examples. Today, we talk about innovation. Innovation is an improved way of doing something. Innovation can lead to change that makes for a better product or idea. Sometimes innovation involves a new physical invention. Some innovations are revolutionary. Innovation brings us to the world of bread and today's expression, the best thing since sliced bread. The best thing since sliced bread describes a new, excellent thing that makes a great improvement to something. For example, the new map and direction app on my smartphone is the best thing since sliced bread. Now, when driving, I find my destinations easily and only get lost when my phone dies. But where does this expression come from? Well, for many years, bread has been a main part of meals for many people around the world. Most bread comes in a long form, called a loaf. A bread loaf travels well. You can buy a loaf of bread, stick it in your bag, and make it home without the bread getting damaged. And on the way, you can break off a piece of bread for a little snack. But when making a sandwich, you need two slices of bread of the same thickness. If you had to cut them yourself, that may not happen. One may be thicker than the other. One of life's little annoyances. Well, that changed in the late 1920s. An inventor in the United States brought an innovation to the world of bread. Otto Frederick Rohwedder invented the bread slicer. The machine cut the bread into individual slices of the same size. Soon after, he invented a machine that sliced the bread and then packaged it. Later, a small machine to toast the bread was invented. The slices fit neatly into the toaster. Toasters can be found in homes across the U.S. and other countries. Sliced bread became even more popular. People love bread, and Rohwedder's creation revolutionized the bread industry. So, being described as the best thing since sliced bread is high praise indeed. Here is another example.
So, what do you think of the chief's new policy on paid leave?
It's the best thing since sliced bread. I'm going to use the extra vacation time to visit friends in Paris.
Please note, people also use this expression as an insult. Let's say you know someone who thinks very highly of herself. She thinks she can do no wrong. You don't agree. You could say, she thinks she's the best thing since sliced bread. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Thank you, Anna. And that's the Learning English broadcast for today. Thanks to my colleagues, Dan Novak, Ashley Thompson, and Katie Weaver. Be sure to join us again tomorrow to keep learning English with stories from around the world. I'm Dan Friedell.